The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest hosting for Desiree Shell. Today we'll be talking about communicating about science through the medium of video. To give us an insider view, I'm really pleased to be joined by two guests today. First, we have Brady Herron. Brady is a former video journalist with the BBC and now an independent science filmmaker. He's the creator of several series of science video in collaboration with researchers from the University of Nottingham, including the Periodic Table of Videos, which has a video for every element of the periodic table, and a few more as well, as well as 60 Symbols, a collection of videos explaining the symbols used in physics and astronomy. He is hard at work on a series of astronomy videos produced directly with YouTube and Google called Deep Sky Videos. Thanks so much for joining us, Brady.
Thank you.
Our second guest is Henry Reich. Henry studied math and physics at Grinnell College in Iowa and received his master's in physics from the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo. He has also worked in the special effects industry in Los Angeles and is the film and media digital artist in residence at the Perimeter Institute. He combines physics with filmmaking in his series Minute Physics. The logo for his series itself has been the subject of one of Brady's 60 Symbols videos. Welcome to the show, Henry.
Thanks for having me, Marie-Claire.
So we'll start off pretty broad. What attracted the two of you to making films, especially online, to communicate about science? And maybe, Brady, we'll start with you.
Well, I'll try and give you the short version of that.
Sounds good.
I was originally a newspaper journalist in Australia, actually, and then I found myself in the UK working for the BBC, and I started making videos, and I started working for the TV news for the BBC. I have a real passion for science, and I enjoyed making news reports about science, but I think one of the real frustrations I found working in television news was the constraints of that medium, the time constraints, the deadlines, the limited time you had to spend with scientists and to actually make your videos. So I started dabbling a little bit on the side, making science YouTube videos, and I just found the freedom of that environment very liberating and also much more effective to make the kind of films I wanted to make. I just started doing more and more of that until it took over my life completely, basically, and now I do that full time.
That's great. And Henry, how about you?
I got my start in kind of film just by doing hobby filmmaking as a high schooler, and then I majored in math and physics, and I always enjoyed teaching and tutoring students. I did some TAing and stuff in college, and always found being able to help people understand the universe as a fun thing to do. After working for these guys with the Freddie W. YouTube channel in Los Angeles doing special effects for them, that opened my eyes to the fact that YouTube was a place where you could go and actually do serious content and not just, you know, the kind of the run-of-the-mill viral videos, which are just random things that people have captured, and you could actually create videos for YouTube. Since I'd been working with these guys who had managed to become successful and do a lot of YouTube video making in just a year, I thought I might as well give it a shot. And I gave it a shot, I guess. Still giving it a shot.
That's great. How did you actually get interested from studying math and physics in doing visual effects at all?
I'm not sure it was that direction. I mean, I was interested in doing visual effects in high school, well before I started doing any sort of serious math and physics. I think it was just sort of a parallel interest. I always liked the idea of visual effects is fun because you get to create kind of alternate universes. You get to create worlds and imagine worlds that are different from the ones that we're in, or you can even, not necessarily different worlds, but you can imagine scenarios which you couldn't otherwise create in film, that you want to create things that would happen in this world that are too dangerous or expensive to film, actually. So that was how I got into special visual effects. I just thought it was a fun thing to do. So I did that in high school quite a bit.
Oh, cool. And you find it serves you pretty well now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does on and off. Sometimes it's an incredible time sink doing visual effects. If you ever have a chance to do a film and you have an option to not do visual effects, you probably should take that option.
That makes sense. Brady, was it anything specific that got you interested in science? I know you were a news journalist before. Was there a specific story that sort of got you interested and pulled you into reporting on science, or a particular person or anything like that?
I think maybe I'm the same story as Henry, but in reverse, whereas I worked in the media and science was kind of my parallel interest. And I guess I just always had a bent towards doing a science story when I could. And in newspapers, I eventually became the science correspondent for my newspaper. And then when I was at the BBC, I would always be the guy that was saying, well, we should do this science story. Or, this is what I've just heard or found out's going on in this area of research. And I was the guy that always wanted to do the science story. So there was no one story that inspired me. I guess I was, I studied science all through school. It was always my favorite subjects, physics and chemistry and whatnot. So I guess I just always had a real natural attraction to it. And, it took over. It took over the journalism side of my life eventually as well.
Nice. It's kind of cool to see how both of you, your paths started early on with a personal interest either in science or filmmaking. Brady, I know your videos have been really popular with teachers and students, and that last year the periodic table of videos was won the Science Magazine's Science Prize for Online Resources in Education. What do you think makes a successful video when you're trying to communicate to a student audience in particular?
I guess for me, because I'm quite a blank canvas, having not done a science degree, I think what works for me in my videos is not thinking about that question and not trying to answer that question, and instead just making a video that I find interesting. So when I go out and spend time with scientists and I'm interviewing them and asking them questions, I'm not thinking about, will this work in a classroom or a lesson? I'm just thinking, is this interesting? Is this amazing? Is this something I want to go home and tell my family and friends? And if it is, I think just by coincidence, it's also really useful for students. And I also think with the sort of videos that a lot of people on YouTube are making, they shouldn't be made as lessons for the classroom, because what I think a lot of teachers want as a resource is something that supplements or complements or is a bit of a deviation from their lesson plan. So I think if you don't think too much about, is this really specifically useful, there's no point repeating what the teachers are going to want to say in class. It's more a case of, is this going to complement it? Is this going to add something or a perspective or a twist that the teachers won't necessarily have? And I think in the case of the way I work, that's why the videos work. I'm not saying there is not a big role to be played for films that are made bespoke for the classroom. But I know my sister's a teacher, for example, not a science teacher, but she's a school teacher, and she's always looking for videos she can show her students that are kind of unexpected, like a 5-minute clip from The West Wing or something that was on some television show or movie or something like that. And I think that's a good way to think about it, to not think, oh, this is good, this is just like a lesson. Because if it's just like a lesson, it's probably not that useful in a lesson, because they're already in a lesson.
Right, the teacher's already doing those things. So is there some parallel in what you do you think, to sort of informal science education, things that go on, say, at science museums or science camps or those sorts of things?
I think there are so many different ways to make science films. And I mean, you're talking to two people today who do it in very, very different ways, had a very different approaches. And if you got another 5 or 6 of us who are in this area, they also do it completely different from how Henry and I do it. And I think, for example, I'm a journalist, and I don't really think of my films as education films. I think of them more as just pieces of journalism that happen to be about science and therefore are quite useful in the field of science education. And then you look at someone like Henry, who's not doing pieces of journalism or reportage. He's making these pieces of art and these really cleverly crafted scripts and snippets of information. I mean, there's just so many different ways to do this. And I think if the successful people are the ones who are kind of playing to their strengths and doing it in their voice and their unique way, and people are sort of latching on to whatever works for them.
That makes sense. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with filmmakers Brady Herron and Henry Reich. Brady is the creator of several science video series, including the Periodic Table of Videos and Deep Sky Videos. And Henry is the creator of Minute Physics. So, Brady, are there any in particular that you think have, where your interest has really translated well into interest from your audience members?
I think I'm interested in everything, and I think, in a way, that's my blessing and my curse. So, I think sometimes I will go and meet with someone and they'll say, oh, you probably don't want to speak to me. What I do is not very interesting. And I've never found that to be true. I think everything is interesting. And if I can't find that out, or if I can't tell their story in a way that's interesting, that's my failure, not their failure. It's my job as a journalist to find things that are interesting. So my videos that have been most interesting and most successful are probably the times when I've done my job the best. And my videos that have been unsuccessful and a little bit boring have been days when I haven't done my job as well.
But it's not so much just because your level of interest was different, but you were more or less successful in translating it?
I think that's the case. I think almost if you're too interested in something, it can become really difficult actually to do your job well. For example, my one personal interest I just happen to have is the moon and the Apollo lunar missions. That's just something I'm personally very interested in my own life. And I think whenever I have to make a film that touches on them, I find that really difficult and I really agonize over it because I know so much about it. And I want the film to be so perfect because it's so much my passion that those ones are actually really hard to make. So I think sometimes when you've got a slight arm's length from the subject, it can make it journalistically slightly easier to tell the story because you're not too clouded by your preconceptions and the story you want to tell, you know, what I want to say. Because when you're a journalist, it should be about what other people are saying and their story. So I find doing what I do, having too much personal involvement, maybe sometimes can hurt you more than it can help you.
Can sort of get in the way of finding the story in a way.
Sometimes, yeah.
Henry, as Brady mentioned, your audience and your videos are slightly different. You, in a really short time, explain some very, very big concepts in, you know, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes time. Your three-part series on the Higgs field and the Higgs boson received a lot of attention from large media outlets. It seemed to really strike a chord in people who were trying to understand the announcements that were coming out of CERN and the Large Hadron Collider. Why do you think those videos and your approach to them were really something that people latched onto?
That's a good question. I think that one of the big things, whenever you have a big new scientific discovery or announcement or something like that, and the Higgs discovery is certainly a big one, is that you have scientists who have this amazing thing that they've just done, and they have their standard way of talking to other scientists about it, and suddenly they're talking to journalists. And the journalists have been talking about other things, and now they have to talk to the scientists about this thing, which in this day and age, science tends to be so specialized or so jargony, basically. You know, you need to have a certain vocabulary in order to understand what the scientists are even saying normally. So what I try to do is in many ways, I'm like one of the subjects of Brady's films. I'm trying to bring across my excitement about something I really like. Whereas he sometimes has an easier time when he isn't as excited about something. Or is passionate about it. But that what I am passionate about is I think that a lot of the times the scientists don't have as much faith in themselves that they actually can explain something that's complicated to the public. And so what I try to do is answer a lot of the questions that the general population has. I think I don't necessarily think about this as a part of my process most of the time, but I talk to people all the time about physics and physics-related stuff, and I answer, you know, talk to friends or, you know, my family or whoever, and I'll be talking about the Higgs boson or something else. And I think that a lot of that is part of my process of understanding what questions people have that aren't being answered by the media about certain aspects of science. And then I try to go in and say, well, the physicists have completely missed explaining this point to the media, or the media have completely missed understanding this point that the physicists were telling them. And I try to kind of answer the questions that people are asking and tell be as true as possible to the science. Cause I definitely think that physicists don't give themselves enough credit that people are able to understand science. And that people are interested in actually some of the details, not necessarily the details of the actual, you know, apparatus or the math, but the details of the kind of the gut core of the physics or other science.
Yeah. The real meaning behind it does hold fascination for people. And I think the reaction to those videos really showed that people wanted to understand.
I think with those, like I made a concerted case or concerted effort, I mean, to really tell the true story of the Higgs as that would make a theoretical physicist happy, and that yet it was accessible to the general public, rather than just spouting off the same words that people have used to talk about things before, but that don't necessarily actually convey what's going on.
So, who do you think about when you think about your audience? Do you have them in mind when you make your videos, Henry?
I don't necessarily think about people in particular. I would say it's generally as if I were trying to explain it to, as I said, a friend or family member who is interested in science but isn't an expert. I'm not going to start at the basics and have to talk about the fact that that electrons exist. I do assume some level, but in many ways, I mean, I think a lot of people will tell you, and maybe this is different for Brady, but a lot of people who make YouTube videos tell you they make videos that they want to watch. And so in many ways, like, I make a video that, like, when I make the videos, it's almost like I'm trying to explain this concept to myself in a simple way. I'm trying to understand this thing without all the trappings of the mathematics and all the trappings of the jargon and the vocabulary that goes around it, and just say, like, what is it actually fundamentally that's going on here? And sometimes I think it's actually helpful even for scientists to do that, to step back and say, can I tell myself in a sentence what I'm doing? Because then you can see, if you see the bigger picture and you're not so lost in the forest, you can actually step back and figure out what's going on. If you have problems that you're trying to solve, it can help you to step back and look and see what other paths there may be that aren't just necessarily the step in front of you, but maybe a path that's, you know, you have to go back and then go off in a different direction, but actually you'll get there faster.
Do you find you actually understand things differently or better through making the videos, even though, I mean, you would have a background in a lot of this stuff?
Yes, I would say that the time when I am most qualified to make one of my videos is immediately after I have finished making it.
That's when you have the very best understanding.
Yes, and in fact, not just immediately after I finished making it, but like an hour or two after it's been posted online, and I get all the comments from people being like, you missed this thing, or like, there's a mistake here. Once I have the process of making it and explaining it and then answering people's questions about things that I screwed up in the video is when I feel like I feel like I should do a thing where I go back and remake every single one of my videos and fix like the little errors and like the things that confuse people and make them clearer, because there are always things like that.
Brady, you've actually gone through in a couple of your series and done updates on different videos. Is that right?
Yes. When we did especially the periodic table of videos, where we did every element on the periodic table, for various reasons I won't bore you with, we actually did all 118 elements in about 6 weeks. And it was a very intense period, and we didn't really do justice to a lot of the elements for that reason. So as periodic videos has continued and we've branched out and done hundreds of videos about all sorts of other aspects of chemistry, we're also going through and doing all the elements again and sort of making them more impressive videos, more information, quite traveling around the world to film bits and pieces for them. So periodic videos in particular is a series that is, it's a living document, I think would be the poser way to describe it.
But that's a cool sort of gift in a way that we have of posting things online, is it can be a constantly evolving thing as opposed to producing a set of DVDs that would go out that people could purchase or producing a book. I mean, it is something that can be added to in that way. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because funnily enough, the YouTube project that started everything for me was this project called Test Tube, or on YouTube, it's called Nottingham Science, and it's something that's still going. And originally what happened was I was kind of commissioned to make a longer form film about science and scientists and what they were doing. So I was going to spend a year or so filming with them kind of all the time as they were doing their job. I mean, to quickly go off my point, something Henry said that really chimed with me was he was talking about, for many scientists, the only time they ever talk to journalists is when something big happens, like a discovery at CERN. And so what I was going to do with this project was not just talk to scientists at that time, but talk to them all the time at all the different stages of their research. So I was filming all these scientists all the time, and the moment when they had their funding rejected, or the moment when some experiment went wrong or went right, or their student did their PhD via, all these moments. And I was going to make them into this one kind of, you know, long form film. And it quickly became apparent that that was a silly thing to do, and it would be a boring film, and maybe some people would watch it, maybe they wouldn't. And instead, what I started doing was taking all the fragments, all the rushes, you would call it in filmmaking, from each day, and making them into these tiny filmlets and putting them on YouTube and letting people watch the film almost in real time, like a reality show. And I think that worked much better. And I think that's kind of what you were saying, in that living document type thing, rather than editing out and stripping away and taking away all the stuff, all the minutiae of science. I wanted to put it out there and let people see it. And that's a spirit that has run through my other projects, even things like periodic videos or 60 symbols or number file or deep sky videos, even though they're a bit more specialized and less journalistic in some ways, that kind of streak of truth and all the bits and pieces of life going into them has remained in it. And I think that's something you can only really do with the freedom that you get online, where there's kind of no rules and no restrictions. I mean, you could never do that on the TV news. If I said, I've got some little moment today where some scientist applied for funding and he got rejected and he's really disappointed and he spoke to me for 8 minutes about how he feels about having his grant rejected, I think the news editor would laugh me out of the newsroom if I said I wanted to put that on the news. Yeah. And yet I can put that on YouTube and people can absorb that. And I think that gives them a deeper understanding of science and scientists. And I think that's something, something that's been missing for many, many years because of the monopoly on the media that's been held by broadcasters. And now that we can all be broadcasters, we can let people see more. We can pull back the curtain and see more of what science is really like.
Yeah, more of the day-to-day, what it really means to do science.
The analogy I always draw is with sport. People love sport. And that's not because they just watch a game every weekend. They love it because they love all the minutia that happens during the week, the injuries and the controversy and the training and the scandal and the who's buying players and selling players and who's got a sore foot and might not play this week and should they have won and shouldn't they have won. All that stuff that happens besides just the big moment is why people love sport. And science never has that. Scientists are these people who kind of disappear for 10 years and then come out once every 10 years and sit in front of a camera like a rabbit in the headlights and say, oh, we've just discovered something, and they get this kind of 5 seconds with a reporter and then that's it. And I think we should see more of them, because the more we see of them, the more we'll realise they're really cool, interesting people. And, you know, they can be really cool heroes, like athletes can be heroes if we give them more time and show what they're doing.
That is absolutely something I can get behind. We'll be right back to talk more of all things science and video with filmmakers Henry Reich and Brady Heron right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to Henry Reich, film and media digital artist in residence at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, and creator of Minute Physics. And we're also joined by Brady Heron, an independent filmmaker and creator of many science video series, including The Periodic Table of Videos, My Favorite Scientist, and Numberphile. Okay, I think we'll go to an audience question here. This is a question from Cram 1032.
Henry, you've said before that you'd like to cover string theory, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Have you had any ideas about how to do it since then?
Yes. I'm kind of constantly absorbing things, and I have friends who are string theorists and work on string theory, and I'm at a physics institute, so I hear about various aspects of these things a lot. String theory isn't the top of my list right now. Hopefully I'll get to it soon, but I have a couple other fascinating things that are coming up in the next few weeks.
Okay, cool. We'll look forward to that. And we talked a little bit earlier about how your videos are actually quite different. Henry, you're very much a part of your videos. So we don't usually see your face, but we see your hand and we hear your voice. And Brady, sometimes you're part of the shot. Sometimes the scientists address you, but sometimes you're also completely behind the camera. Is there a difference between, or some kind of value in having the filmmaker be a real part of these videos?
I think that in YouTube in general, one of the big differences between YouTube and between a lot of broadcasts, although depending on what aspect of broadcast, people really like to have a personality behind a show or behind what they're watching. They like to feel that there's somebody there. And in some ways it is similar to, you know, like Oprah or Stephen Colbert or something like that, where you actually have a personality. You're going there to to hear what this person has to say and what they want, because they have interesting thoughts and interesting ways of talking about something, an interesting perspective. And I think in YouTube in general, that's really, like, you can get science information anywhere you want. Like, Wikipedia is there. You can search it. You can find the stuff on the internet. We don't, like, as science or as science video makers or as any sort of video maker, you know, if you're a makeup tutorial person on YouTube, whatever you do, this information is available somewhere else. That's point, you know, point blank. What you bring to it is the perspective and the interpretation. And that's, you know, we were talking about my Higgs videos earlier. I think that's where it's my, what people liked about that was that it was a different perspective from what they just hear all the time, a different take on it, a different interpretation of how to tell that story. And so I would say that my, you know, the way that I happen to be able to do that is by drawing stick figures and talking, because that's when I talk to people about science, I tend to like to draw really scratchy little pictures and explain things. And I think Brady obviously comes from a journalism standpoint, and he can tell the story. And in many ways, it is his voice, because, I mean, having been interviewed by Brady, he asks amazing questions and really directs it. And a lot of times you don't necessarily hear the questions that he has asked, because he asks questions in such a way that he gets the scientists will say things that allow him to just cut to them and have them tell the story, but he's really guiding them through the story. That's at least my perspective on it. I don't know what he wants to say from the other side of the camera.
Brady?
I mean, I agree with everything Henry just said then completely. I've uploaded over 1,000 videos to YouTube now, so certainly I think people have kind of know who I am now, and they associate me with my videos, whether I speak a lot in them or not. I mean, my attitude to that is, it's what's really important to me is that my videos are an honest depiction of what happened in the room. And sometimes it's not necessary to have my voice in the video or me in the video to convey that. Sometimes if there's a bit of banter, a bit of discussion between me and the scientists that better informs the interview, I will leave that in the interview, so people have got to know me in that way, because I have a relationship with these scientists. I spend so much time with them, and kind of the dynamic of that relationship sometimes improves the video to hear us joking and hear my questions and whatnot. So I think the videos are my voice, and sometimes me being in the video makes it better. Sometimes it's just not necessary and becomes a distraction. But certainly, when I'm not in the video, there is someone in the video, and the people in my videos are sort of recurring characters. Some of them have been in hundreds and hundreds of videos, and people feel like they have a relationship with them, with me, with Henry. And that relationship's really important, because these people trust us, and they're giving us their time, and they're entitled to feel they have a relationship with us because they do, you know, and we have a relationship with them because we're making these videos for them. So I think it's an important part of it. And I'm certainly not so precious about journalism to think that, oh no, I must never be heard or seen. I think, you know, that would be dishonest. It would be dishonest to suggest that these scientists are just sitting in a room on their own, talking to a webcam and making these films. You know, I'm part of it, and they're being influenced by me, and they're being questioned by me, and I'd like to be really upfront about that.
So really about creating a relationship, whether or not it's in front of the camera, whether or not it's always your voice or making that connection with you, but still making a personal connection with the video seems really important to you guys.
Definitely.
Yeah. One thing that I think has been contributing to this seems to be the collaborations that have been going on recently. And I've had a couple questions sent on that topic. So we'll go to one from the chat from Dusky.
Henry and Brady, will we see any more collaborations between you and other YouTubers in the future?
I should start by saying on this subject, the reason that you've been seeing a lot of those collaborations lately is in a massive, massive part due to Henry himself, who actually organized a big get-together between a whole lot of the science YouTubers.
And other people like Marie Claire.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I think all of us being in the same place for the first time was a surreal experience, but also opened our eyes to the possibilities, but it also just geographically made that possible. And we sort of, in a short space of time, did a lot of collaborating, but we also built a lot of friendships and relationships that have made subsequent collaborations possible. I know some of us are all coming together again later this year, so I think you can expect another influx of slightly bonkers collaborative videos, but I think it's been quite fun and stimulating for us to do it, and also it's been an interesting way to open our audience's eyes to some of the other amazing content that some of our friends are making, because I think sometimes maybe we get a bit siloed. I know when I made a few videos about Henry and Derek from Veritasium and Destin from Smarter Every Day and all people like that, a lot of people who watch my videos sort of said, oh, I'd never heard of these guys or seen these videos, and that's brilliant. And that's completely amazing to me, because obviously these guys are making incredible videos, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't believe you're watching my rubbish and you've never seen Henry's videos. But in that respect, it's been really good, and also it's been a real blessing for people like me, who's a bit smaller on the scene than Henry, to have the audience of guys like him and Destin Smart Every Day and that realize that I even exist has been quite useful. So the collaborations have not only been a lot of fun, but they've also been a bit of an opportunity as well to kind of let other people know what we're doing.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with science filmmakers Brady Herron and Henry Reich. So Brady was just talking about some of the collaborations that you guys have done and mentioned a meeting that happened this spring, talking about the Brainstem conference that was hosted in Waterloo. Henry, you were really involved in that. Can you tell us a little bit about the meeting and what your motivations were for bringing all those people together?
There were many reasons to want to have, it was an unconference, I guess, based in many ways on the philosophy of unconferences, similar to Science Online, which is a big science science blogger and journalism unconference. But also even on things, and some of this I realize in retrospect, but there were a lot of famous physics conferences, very important physics conferences that happened in the 20s and even the teens, you know, with relation to quantum mechanics. And the development of the understanding of quantum theory, where they would bring together, say, you know, 25 of the top physicists of the day, and they would have several days where they didn't have a set schedule, and they were just trying to talk and figure out what was going on, and everyone was kind of getting up to speed and meeting each other. And even though we're in such a more digitally connected age now, and like most of the people who came to the conference had seen each other's work, I still think it's very important to have that personal, you know, being in the same place, connection where you can have a conversation and talk to somebody and, you know, go out to dinner with them or whatever it may be, play music with them. And I had seen that kind of collaboration and interaction in YouTubers in Los Angeles when I was working there. And that's LA has kind of become the place where a lot of YouTubers go once they decide that they're making YouTube their profession rather than just kind of a hobby thing. And I think it's because some of them started going there because that's where, you know, actors and film people go. And then you got there was a critical mass, and that's where a lot of the other YouTubers have gone. And there's a potential to do things beyond YouTube as well. But the thing with the education and the science YouTubers is that we're not in Los Angeles. We're all over the place. And a lot of the kind of the collaboration and the kind of infectious, you know, like excitement of making videos and working together and kind of almost it's like a positive, like a collaborative one-upmanship. Like you always want to make, you see what a video someone else has made and it inspires you to make like another good video. Like you want to make another video faster and better just because somebody else is also doing it. So bringing those people together, was kind of a really important thing. And I thought, you know, no one had really, I mean, a lot of our channels, I mean, Brady is a big exception, but a lot of the kind of the education and science YouTube channels have only started up in the last year and a half to 2 years. And so various people, like I'd met Michael Stevens of Vsauce individually, but I don't think I'd met anyone else other than that. So like in person. So it was really, I thought it was a unique moment to be able to bring everyone together. And of course, at the time of organizing it, I didn't know if everyone was going to come, either be interested or available to come. And I was astounded that pretty much everyone, other than potentially Hank Green of Crash Course and SciShow, he was pretty much the only person who I invited who was unable to come. So of the actual YouTubers.
Yeah, it was a really great collection. And watching the videos that you guys made together there while you were all interacting, they've been a lot of fun to watch and give a lot of insight into how you do what you do.
It was interesting that since the conference, Henry and Derek from the channel Veritasium actually were in the UK not long after, and they came up to Nottingham and spent a couple of days here visiting me, and they came out to dinner with my wife and I. And afterwards, my wife turned to me and was just laughing and said, "I didn't realize there are other people like you out there." So it's also reassuring to know there are other people who are as obsessive about making science videos as I am. I was like, "See, I'm not the only one."
That is a nice.
It could be worse. It could be worse. You could be married to Henry.
Wow, that is a whole other question. Well, we were talking a little bit about the knowledge and how you think about your audience earlier. And I just want to bring in another audience question here. So this is a question that was asked on the website by Tony.
How do you approach mathematical concepts in your videos?
Maybe I'll turn to you first, Henry, because dealing with theoretical physics, there's probably a big question always in how much math to do and how to approach it.
This is something that I struggle with a lot. And I think that a lot of popular science writers struggle with this as well. And in many ways, it gives a false impression, because if you read pretty much any pop sci book about physics, it doesn't have equations in it. And if you read any, you know, work done by physicists, it's a lot of equations. So there's a disconnect there. But I think that many times the math, if you get into the nitty gritty details of the math, math is in many ways for physicists the same as, you know, like the experimental apparatus and setup. For a chemist or for an experimental physicist, like, are you going to explain the Large Hadron Collider by telling somebody about, you know, like the way you wired the superconductors? Probably not. You know, like, it's important in terms of the experiment, but it's not actually important in explaining what's going on.
Right.
And so if it's possible to kind of get a more of a emotional, visual or kind of a heuristic picture of the math, of what the math is doing. And the beautiful thing about math is that very often there are kind of simple cases for a complicated thing. Like, there are many areas of mathematics where there's just, you know, a very kind of broad theory, and complicated theory will have one, like, simple example. In physics, the simple example is normally like a spring, right? A spring vibrates back and forth. That's all it does. And we understand it very well. And you can explain it to people. Or a pendulum. You know, a pendulum swings. It just swings back and forth. Mm-hmm. And pendula and springs are really, really good models, simple examples of really, really complicated things in physics, but often you can describe the really complicated math by analogy of the simple spring. And I think maybe I'm unusual, but I doubt it. I think most physicists even often think about the really complicated things in terms of the simple ones. When you're actually doing this complicated math, your intuition comes from the simple picture, the basic picture, and then you have to adjust it to deal with the kind of the more complexities of it. But most of the time, I mean, I've done some things I've done with equations, you know, I've talked about infinity mainly. But I think that there's a lot of beauty in math that you can get visually, and kind of more of a gut feeling, or going for the core of what the math is saying rather than the details of how the math works, in the same way that an experimentalist would not need to explain, you know, the wiring of their experiment.
Yeah, that's a really interesting analogy. I had never thought about it in that way. We'll be right back with more talk of all things science and video with filmmakers Henry Reich and Brady Heron right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at two science stories making headlines and stirring debate. Science writer David Dobbs returns to the show to discuss the misuse of neuroscience in Naomi Wolf's new book, Vagina, a Biography. And genetics researcher Michael White joins us to sort out the science from the hype in the results from the ENCODE genomics project. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to Henry Reich, film and media digital artist in residence at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, and creator of Minute Physics. I'm also joined by Brady Heron, independent science filmmaker and creator of several video series, including The Periodic Table of Videos, My Favorite Scientist, and Numberphile. So I think we'll pick back up where we were with thinking about how to address math concepts. Brady, do you have anything to add to that?
This has been one of the most vexed questions in the making of 60 Symbols videos, which are about physics, because I'm not particularly gifted at mathematics, and I have always had a a ban of sorts on the use of equations and mathematics in 60 Simples videos, which has caused much angst and many arguments and debate off camera between me and the physicists. And I've always heard them say, but you can't understand this without the math, or the math is so beautiful here, it has to be shown. And I've always argued against it. I've always said to them, look, I believe you, but mathematics is a language that some people can't speak. And there's no point making a video, our videos are made in the English language, and there's no point making an English language video in a language that people don't speak. And they'll say, but you don't understand the beauty of it and whatnot. And I would always say, well, Shakespeare was written in English. Does that mean that everyone who doesn't speak English is not allowed to understand or know what the Shakespeare plays are about because they don't speak English? That's not true. Obviously, you can translate them or explain it to someone who only speaks French. And of course, they're not understanding the true beauty of what Shakespeare wrote, but at least they're getting to know what the story's about and what the big deal is with this Shakespeare guy. So that's how I've always explained it to them. Look, we're going to do it in English. We're going to do it in English. We're not going to do it in math. And you have to help me explain it without the mathematics. And there's been a tension there, but we've always done it. Mm-hmm. Recently, I've started making these number file videos, which are all about numbers, and there's a lot of mathematics in there. And I've thrown that rule out the window, obviously. I've said, okay, here's your piece of paper and here's your pencil. It's going to be hard for me, but you're allowed to use your math now. Let's see how it goes. And actually, those videos have been really, really popular too. And a lot of people have been really pleased to see them and want more of it. So, and other people have probably been completely blown away by it and stopped watching altogether. So I think there is room to have the hardcore math in videos on YouTube. But I also think there's a lot to be said for not having it. And I think, I don't know, that's the great thing about YouTube, isn't it? If you don't want it, you can watch something amazing like something that Henry does, where he's managed to strip back the math and tell the essence of the story without it. And if you do want a bunch of hardcore math, you can go and watch some MIT hour-long lecture and drown in the stuff. And I think that's really good, isn't it? It's no longer a case of you only get what's served up by a few television channels and you have to accept it. In the world of YouTube, you can watch someone who's clever at telling the story without math, or you can go and watch someone who is going to completely drown you in it. Either way, it works, and I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, how important do you think that sort of free choice aspect is of watching these kind of videos? Do you even think about that when you're making it, that, you know, if this is what people want to watch, then they can come here and watch that?
I think people watching my videos should be compulsory for everyone in the world.
Compulsory?
I don't know. I don't like that people have free choice.
Well, they're compulsory in my office, Brady. So,
yeah, and my house.
I think that there is a big, like, you have to always be aware of the fact on YouTube that people are coming there by choice, but I think that's more of a boon. Like, because most people who make videos on the internet or on YouTube or on the broader internet do it and have started kind of from scratch, from their own, you know, they started at a very small scale and gradually kind of gained a wider audience. They started off making the kind of videos that they want to make and that they like to make. And they have their own style and they've kind of established that. And cause if you look at the kind of the first to second videos for a lot of the YouTubers that the science YouTubers out there or other people who make internet videos, the very early videos are in many ways very similar to the more recent ones. Like the more recent ones may be more polished. They might be a little fancier, but the essence is there in the early ones. You can see that, like, watching those early ones, you're like, this is the same person. This is what made this person, person's videos, you know, successful, or why people like their videos. Mm-hmm. And so because you've gained the audience, in a very organic way, it's like the audience is people who like what you're doing. You just, in many ways, like, it's almost better to not think about the audience too much, because if you start thinking about them, then you might do stuff for them rather than what you want to be doing. And what they want is what you want to be doing. So I think that's, you know, it's something to, at some point you have the audience in the back of your mind, but in many times I just think, you know, I just want to make the video that I want to make, and people have liked them in the past, so hopefully they'll like them in the future.
Yeah, that's what brought them there.
Yeah.
That's so true. That's exact. Henry couldn't have said something more true than what he just said. I think we have to be, it's unfortunate for us that we have to read every single comment of every single viewer, because you have to have thick skin doing this. I think if the people who make mainstream television shows or Hollywood movies had to read the comments of every single person that watched every single minute of every single one of their shows, they would be crippled by indecision and would never make any program again. And I think what Henry said is true. We have to kind of plow on and just keep making what we think is right, because that's kind of what got us here in the first place. And if you start trying to please every single person, including the vocal minority, you start tearing apart what you've created in the first place.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, certainly every time I think, have a thought about a television show, it doesn't get recorded right underneath it. But often when people are watching online videos, they really do comment any and all kinds of things. Do you think there's any benefit to that kind of interaction as well, though? I mean, there's the, you have to develop a thick skin, but is there any benefit to being able to meet your audience in that way through the comment spaces?
I think it's an amazing benefit. I think it makes it feel very different from, this is one of the big differences between online content and broadcast, is that there is that sort of interaction between the audience and the creator. And in many ways, as kind of distant as the video makers may be, you still realize that they're just people and they can write back to you and respond. You know, like I can write to John Green or to Brady Heron or to Derek, and get a response back. Maybe if they, you know, a lot of people, this is something that a lot of people don't realize, that a lot of YouTubers do read pretty much all the comments or all their YouTube messages. They don't necessarily reply, because that would take an incredible amount of time, or necessarily, you know, a reply isn't necessarily appropriate. But, you know, I have to admit, I don't read all of the comments on my videos. I get several thousand of them within, you know, 2 hours of having uploaded a video. So I'll kind of look at the top comments, and I'll, you know, every, you know, half hour or an hour for the couple, first couple hours after uploading a video, I'll look at kind of an assortment of the comments to see how people are responding. But I don't read every single one, but I do read every single message that somebody sends me on YouTube. I don't necessarily reply, but I try to reply at some point, and I do read them all.
That's cool. So it really opens up different kinds of interactions, doesn't it?
It's also not just the interaction between the viewers and the filmmakers, but the other thing that's brilliant is it opens up the interaction between fellow viewers. And quite often I'll see a question under a video, which will be maybe a science question or something like that. And even if I do know the answer, I often won't answer, because I know before I even finish typing my answer, 30 other viewers will answer that question for them, and they'll start a discussion, and who knows what tangent they'll go off on. Sometimes they'll go off on some ridiculous conversation about, you know, religion or the price of eggs or if their favourite colour's pink. But other times they'll go into these sort of really detailed discussions about science that's well above my head. But I find it really amazing to think that I've just posted this video, and then underneath there's this really highbrow science discussion going on where they're explaining ideas to each other and discussing things. And I think that's really great. I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that I've played a tiny role in creating these forums and these places where people are coming together and discussing this stuff. It's brilliant. Yeah.
That's an excellent point.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with science filmmakers Brady Heron and Henry Reich. So we were talking a little bit, when we were talking about math, the idea of language came up. And I want to go to another listener question. So this is a question from the chat from Dusky.
Henry, can you tell us more about translating videos into other languages?
This person probably is paying attention to what I've been doing recently.
I'm thinking the same thing.
I have just recently, as in like last Friday, launched an app. It's at translate.minutephysics.com, where you can go to basically download the English version of the subtitle for a minute physics video, and then translate it into any other language that's accepted by YouTube, and then re-upload the subtitle, and it will automatically, after some minor vetting to make sure it's not spam, will go and become a subtitle on the YouTube videos. And I think that this is a really important thing to do, is to be able to share content with people internationally, because I do get a lot of, you know, emails from people saying, oh, it's great that you're doing these videos, it's helping both my science and my English. But at the same time, there are people who wish that they could watch these videos. I do talk very quickly in mine in particular. So people who wish they could watch the videos sometimes even just English subtitles, so they can pause and see what I had just said, or else subtitles in their own language. And it's, again, it's another way of community involvement and allowing people to kind of contribute to having kind of a dialogue. And so the main reason that I didn't build this app. I have a excellent, brilliant, friend and web designer who has helped do that. I just kind of helped design what it should do. The main reason to do it is because YouTube has horrendous, subtitle, like, management. Like, you have to basically go through about 5 or 6 steps to upload a subtitle to one video in one language. And so if you're having, you know, people offering, like, I get emails where people offer to translate videos. They want to translate videos into Hebrew or French or whatever language it is. And they say, I'll get an email where this person has emailed me, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 translated subtitles. And I say, like, that's great, but it's going to take me 2 hours to upload these to YouTube because YouTube is such a horrendous system for doing it. So in many ways, it's like, it's this thing where, like, I felt there was a need to do it, and I didn't want to just say I'm not going to bother translating them. Mm-hmm. But I saw there was a need for this kind of thing, and hopefully we can then give this system, you know, to Brady and to Derek and to Gray and to the Green Brothers and to anyone who wants to be able to translate, to have subtitles translated by the public on their YouTube videos. Because there are other places to do subtitle translation online, but none of them actually link back and re-upload the stuff to YouTube. Which in many ways is beside the point because people are watching it on YouTube. So if you have it translated somewhere else and no one watches it, it's almost like a wasted effort.
Right. So do you think this is going to really open it up to a different kind of, either different kind of audience or different audiences?
I hope so. I have no concept of whether it will how much it'll open it up to other audiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can definitely say that it has been a resounding success. At least I've, in the first, you know, 2 or 3 days, we've had like 200 subtitles submitted, like translated subtitles submitted. So that's almost like, you know, becoming a minor job for me to just kind of go through and make sure that there actually are all real subtitle files. But I do certainly hope that it allows other people to kind of, who might not have otherwise watched the videos, to watch them. And at some point it would be also nice, to maybe translate. I've thought about if I get all the videos translated, subtitles and translated into Spanish. You know, I speak enough Spanish that I would consider almost just redubbing them all in Spanish and release them all in Spanish. I think that would be really fun. It would be quite a bit of work, but it's the kind of thing that I think the value that you get out of that would be really, really worth it. So, and I think that, you know, international, like, science is an international thing, and as much as we're talking about language, you know, of the language of physics, at least, is math, and the language of science is often English, but the language of science outreach is not English. You know, the language of science outreach is the language of the people, wherever they may be. So that is an issue that we kind of come across. And I don't actually know if there are, this is a really good question, what maybe Brady knows, do you know of any people who are making science videos on YouTube that are in other languages?
I don't. There must be, but I haven't come across a lot of them. I mean, there's a museum in Rio that really liked the periodic table of videos, and they subtitled all of our videos in Portuguese, and they actually created this installation at their museum in Rio, which is fabulous, where you can go along and there's a big periodic table and every element is a big cube, a big block in a wall, and you can take that block out of the wall and walk over to this TV screen and place that block in this sort of cube-shaped hole under the screen like a key, and when you put that element box under the TV, our video starts playing, all subtitled in Portuguese. And I know they're quite keen to sort of put some Portuguese dubbing onto the videos as well. So what Henry says, I mean, what Henry's doing sounds like total genius, and I'll be contacting him very quickly afterwards to chat to him about it. But there is this huge appetite, and there's a lot of people there who, you know, who want to hear what's being said, and maybe can't always. I do like the idea that people saying they're learning English from Henry. I'm just imagining billions of people around the world learning their English from Henry, and then all coming for holidays to the UK and speaking at 1,000 miles an hour when they get here. It'd be brilliant.
That cube, that installation display sounds brilliant.
There's a video about it on Periodic Video. So yeah. you and anyone who's listening, if they ever want to go and see what it looks like and how it works, but it was really interesting to see. It was really good fun.
That's great. Brady, I wanted to follow up with you a little bit about language. You talked in the beginning a little bit about the difference between moving from being a print journalist to kind of moving into video and in particular into online video. Is there any sort of affordances in the way that you can use language in an audiovisual medium that would be different than, say, text and writing about science?
As someone who made the move from newspaper to sort of online BBC website to TV, the language is very different in terms of scripting. I mean, I don't do a lot of scripting anymore because other people speak in my videos and none of my videos are scripted. But I'm sure someone like Henry will tell you, for people who do write scripts, you know, it's a real art form writing a script for a piece of television or a piece of film. And I think they're different art forms. And, you know, when I first made the transition between, made the different jumps, you know, it's a steep learning curve to suddenly, you know, in TV, you have to strip away so many words and tell a story with fewer words. A lot of people think TV is dumb and dumbing down and newspapers are a bit more highbrow, but as someone who's worked for both, I can testify to what a challenge it is to tell a story for television or for video. And I think all the different skills you learn are quite useful. I mean, as someone who, you know, has to maintain about a dozen different websites and blogs and things like that, I think having an ability to write and an ability to make a website, even though my websites, you know, are hardly world class, but the ability to make videos and edit videos and have all these different skills, I think that's the way of the future. And I think these kind of media polymaths that are starting to be spat out all around the world are well placed to work and live in the world that we've created.
And Henry, as someone who does use scripts, do you find it's different than sort of writing a description for someone about your topics?
Slightly. I have the added benefit of being able to, at the back of my mind, think, oh, I can actually draw a picture for this and explain it visually. And, you know, visualizations are incredibly helpful. I think that's obviously the biggest difference between radio or between print and between video or film, is that you can use images to tell the story. I think it can also be, it can be a detriment as well, because it's very easy to use the wrong image and use something that's unrelated to what you're saying or doesn't quite get the right point across, and in which case you can actually be more misleading to have it. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. But I always tell people, like, first I am a writer, then I make videos, because that is my process. You know, I write scripts. I know other people who do videos, like Vi Hart does similar style videos. You could say, you know, she narrates and draws.
Yeah.
But I believe she writes her script, then does all her drawings, then comes back and, you know, redoes the script and you know, improvises, you know, narration to what she has drawn. Whereas I am very much, you know, I will write exactly the words that I want to say, and then I'll figure out what's the best way of illustrating that and how the illustrations can kind of add to and help people better understand what's being said, you know, to add to the words.
Well, thank you guys both so much for sharing so much of your process and what you've done over the years. It's really, really interesting to hear, having enjoyed a lot of the videos myself. Really interesting to hear more about what's behind them. So thank you so much for being here and helping us gain some insight on communicating science through video.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. It was good fun.
You'll find links to both Henry and Brady and their video channels on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so you can keep up with the show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program and listen to past episodes. Thanks for listening.
Before we go, we want to let you know about a Canadian skeptics group raising money for a very worthy cause. Back in episode 173, we let you know about Bad Science Watch, a new watchdog organization that's working to counter pseudoscience and misinformation in the media, from the government, and on store shelves. And all that diligence takes money, and so the London Skeptics in Ontario are stepping up to help Bad Science Watch and its work. London Skeptics has issued a challenge to its members and to skeptics groups across Canada. From now until the end of October, they'll be collecting donations, and they're betting they can bring in more money than any other group. So London Skeptics has thrown down the gauntlet, people. So if you think you can do better, or you just want to help bring a scientific perspective to the public in Canada, every donation is a huge help. You'll find links for Bad Science Watch and the London Skeptics Fundraising Challenge on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.